Good morning, Your Honor. Kyle Edgerton on behalf of Mr. Trigueros-Quizar, and I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Very well.
May it please the court, my client, Angel Trigueros-Quizar, is a young Guatemalan man with virtually no formal education. He was abandoned by his parents. He experienced discrimination in his home country due to his indigenous ethnicity, his language, his practice of evangelical Christianity as opposed to Catholicism. And he suffered various forms of discrimination as a result that included physical abuse, psychological abuse, and even sexual abuse. He fled Guatemala for the United States, arrived here as a 21-year-old young man, and ended up in Reno. He had a brother here. And he came to Reno right as this area was experiencing a lot of tumult due to some recent changes to how court administrative matters were carried out, with the result that many practitioners, myself included, backed away from taking on many new asylum cases. That created this crisis of access to counsel that we tried to close that hole with a series of periodic workshops, asylum workshops. And so Mr. Trigueros Angel came to those workshops a number of times, received some basic assistance with preparing his asylum application, submitted it, and eventually got his case scheduled for an individual hearing or a merits hearing on his asylum-based claims. In his account, he leaves ample time to get to that hearing, which is scheduled for 1 p.m. on a particular day, September 1st, 2023, suffers a flat tire en route, is able to find some assistance for an emergency flat repair, arrives by his account about 5 minutes late. Now, another one of these unique features of immigration practice in Reno is that we don't have an actual immigration court. We don't have any judges who were assigned to Reno. We don't have any staff. And so when Angel arrives, in his account, 5 minutes late to that hearing, there's no court staff for him to grab. There's no door for him to pound on to say, hey, XYZ happened. I'm a little bit late. Can you please hear my case? Instead, the judge sitting remotely had called his case, we assume, at the designated hour, finding him not in the courtroom, ordered him removed in absentia, and that was the decision that was made. Now, in his account, he asked security staff, court out of basically pretrial supervision staff to make some calls to do something to try to help, but that was to no avail. He then comes to the next workshop where he sought assistance with this matter. I missed my court hearing. What can I do? And of course, the statute provides for a mechanism within 180 days to request a reopening of a case. Again, in a workshop setting, we're kind of doing triage, MASH style field medicine. And so we put together a basic pleading explaining what the basis for his missed hearing was. And the only real evidence that we had available to tender was a receipt from the same tire shop that had rendered that emergency flat repair. And he explained in basically this self-styled pleading that, you know, I didn't get a receipt for my emergency flat repair. I gunned it to get to immigration court. But then I went back 2-3 weeks later, realizing obviously I didn't have, my tires weren't up to the best shape. And so I went back and patronized this business in order to thank them.
Can I ask you about
please
that? Because you said the only thing that was available to him, but why couldn't he have gone to the tire shop and said, hey, can I get a little note from you all that, and especially having bought tires from him a few weeks later, maybe they would be willing to do that.
Yeah.
Maybe even if they didn't have a recollection of it, they would still be willing to do it if he bought tires. The reason I ask that is because in some ways it seems to me that that this receipt for that he bought tires 3 weeks later, I understand your story about that, but it's almost like, feels like, like if my kid was to bring me that evidence of having done something, it's a little bit like if you were, say, I have a receipt for donuts that I bought 3 weeks later. This is my documentary evidence because I bought these donuts to give to them to say thank you. And I don't know, would that actually count as anything?
Thank you, Judge Van Dyke. It's not great, right? And again, as you know, the person who, again, in full candor, I think this is this the cat was never really in the bag, but the cat is fully out of the bag. But I was the one that basically helped him prepare that.
Yeah, well, why didn't he get a note from them?
Yeah, because he shows up at 7 p.m. on a Thursday evening, and this is what we've got to work with, and we're not going to see him again for 3 months.
So is it because they? I guess what I'm at is it because they can't. They won't provide a note? They don't remember it?
No, I mean we don't. Those facts aren't in evidence. I think, you know, again, 2020 hindsight. Certainly, there's things that we could have and should have done. In the situation
that's an
that
interesting question.
Yeah.
Does he?
I agree with Judge Van Dyke's point that he's making that it would be a better showing if that evidence was in the record. But my question is, does it need to be in the record?
Right.
Because we have case law that talks about at this procedural point in a case, we don't have hearings, and so there is a presumption given to the petitioner's statement unless it's inherently unbelievable. And we have the agency in this case saying that it was not inherently unbelievable. And so I'm trying to figure out, like, what is the burden on the petitioner in this moment in terms of the evidentiary showing?
I agree. Thank you, Judge Forrest. And again, I agree. There's a million things that if I had a time machine, I would change about this particular case, including my own role in some aspects of it. But to your point, yes, I think our case law is clear that we're supposed to treat these claims as being, unless they're inherently unbelievable, as true. And then really the IJ's analysis, which the Board of Immigration Appeals piggybacked on, is essentially a case law driven analysis. I would make a lot of hay about the IJ's use of the Perez v. Mukasey case from 2008 and the misreading of that. So yes, I think it's sufficient that Angel said, hey, I was there. Hey, there was tire trouble. And that's probably enough for us to at least do the analysis and decide whether that was sufficient.
Does it affect anything that you know, say, in theory under our case law, and I'm not sure how this comports with Ming Dai, and you know, our court has a history of saying you have to believe people, and then the Supreme Court, when they see it, they're like, no, you know, the agency gets to, just like courts typically do, they get to decide things. But putting that aside, does it affect anything as far as our sort of deemed true rule for this particular area, that if somebody does come in and try to provide evidence, can the agency, you know, corroborating evidence, because they did hear, can the agency look at that and be like, no, that doesn't corroborate at all, and that actually, the fact that you've tried to provide this so-called corroborating evidence that doesn't corroborate at all sort of cuts against your story. You know, same way if, like, you brought in a receipt for fireworks, mm-hmm. and you said, you know, we bought some fireworks, and I gave these to the tire shop owner because I really liked them, and we'd be like, that's super weird. Like, that doesn't corroborate at all, and the fact that you're trying to corroborate it that way, that's what we would be in real life,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah.
So does that affect it, or are we just stuck with the deemed true rule?
Well, I think as a case law matter, we're stuck with the deemed true rule, but that is our guiding principle. And then additionally, with regard to this particular case, given the posture, and I spent a fair amount of time explaining this context that we're in Reno, because Angel did not have access to counsel with their kind of full preparation to file this. Maybe he should have. Maybe the direction ought to have been, you got to come back, you got to find someone to help you with this, because we're not going to be able in 45 minutes to put together something that's
sufficient. Well, sometimes the fact that often they don't have counsel in these cases, mm-hmm. and sometimes it's actually the fact that they don't have counsel, what they did feels more genuine, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. like counsel creates a scripted record for people, and that's what they do. If they don't have counsel, and what they do is they come in with an irrelevant receipt, that, you know, I think most of us, if we didn't have our lawyer or judge's hats on, we'd be like, huh, that actually seems to cut against it.
And we can see that it does to a small extent. I think, again, given the case posture, the case law that's guiding here, it ought to be sufficient that even if we don't want to follow deemed true all the way down the rabbit hole, the burden is not so heavy on Angel at that point that he needed to overcome that burden. It was sufficient to show something and then give a cogent explanation. I do want to step back at this time just to save a bit of time.
Well, I'll give you a little extra time because we've asked you a lot of questions.
Sure.
I do want to ask you this, is that at the end of the day, let's say we agree with you that his statement was enough. It wasn't inherently unbelievable. I guess it was something better than that.
Mm-hmm.
What do we do next in this case? What do you want us to do?
Right. And let me preview that. I'll be happy to come back to it later. I would basically ask the court to do a two-part analysis. The first is to question whether there's essentially plain error in the BIA's review of the IJ's decision. As Mr. O'Malley is going to point out on behalf of the government, there's a pretty thin record here in terms of the arguments that were raised to the board because the appellate brief is not part of that record. That's one of these many other things that I'd love I could change. So we're a little bit caught between everything that led up to the IJ decision itself, the motion, and then we're more or less with a blank slate when it comes to the board. And so I'd ask the court to determine whether there is essentially plain error in looking through the BIA's decision toward the IJ's analysis and then onto the motion to reopen to see if there is plain error on one of these different aspects. If there is, there needs to be remand. If there's not, I'm ready to concede that there's not enough of a developed record here for me to win on some kind of non-plain error analysis as to the analysis in the motion to reopen. But I would then fall back on the abuse of discretion in not accepting the minimally late filed appellate brief or the motion to reopen, the motion to accept that late filed appellate brief, which denudes the record from that more robust discussion. A lot of the government's arguments here were about, well, this issue wasn't exhausted, this issue wasn't raised. Well, that's all an artifact of the board declining to accept the late filed brief.
So what if we were to say that on the motion to reopen analysis, we think that the BIA got it wrong because it was believable enough. Therefore, you need to go back and redo the motion to reopen analysis, not saying you didn't prove it, but assuming you did prove it, is that enough to reopen?
Right. I would agree. If the court's comfortable saying that the board got something wrong on the actual merits analysis of the motion to reopen, then that ought to be sufficient to remand it to the board with instructions, I suppose, however the court wanted to direct it. If the court's willing to say that that was wrong, my preference would be for the court to direct supplementary briefing. That way, these fuller arguments would come in before the board. The board can consider the entire factual and evidentiary and argumentative record and make a new decision.
All right. Thank you. And I'll give you the 3 minutes.
I appreciate it.
May it please the court, my name is Andrew O'Malley. I represent the Attorney General of the United States. We ask that the court deny the petition for review because the agency acted within its discretion both when it denied the motion to reopen to rescind the in absentia removal order and when it denied petitioner's motion to accept the untimely administrative appeal brief. I feel like I should start with the deemed true rule. I think there is the rule that statements by pro se movements are deemed true unless inherently unbelievable, and the agent
is that a do other circuits have that rule, or is that a Ninth Circuit rule?
I'm not familiar with it in other circuits, Your Honor. I can't say definitively whether.
So if we were to rely on that rule, if we issued a published opinion on that, is that something that would make sense to go to the Supreme Court and get fixed like they did in Ming Dai?
I don't think you need to rely on it here, because the issue is yes, perhaps it's deemed true, but there's a difference between being credible and being persuasive, and that's the issue here. Was that persuasive? And that's consistent with this court's recent en banc decision in Monteo, which we 28J'd back in March, I believe.
Okay, so I think I understand the distinction that you're trying to make, which is there's a difference between what is the evidentiary information that the agency should be considering.
Correct.
And whether the case presents a circumstance where the exceptional circumstances standard can be met. And I entirely agree with that. The problem with this case that I'm having is I think we've been very clear since the 1980s, at least, that we have this rule that says that you've got to accept the facts stated by the petitioner as true unless they're inherently unbelievable. And in this case, the IJ doesn't do that. The IJ goes through all the corroborating evidence and just says you haven't met your burden of proof, and never even references that I'm going to accept the story of this tire situation as true. So we have the IJ not following that. And then we have the IJ also saying that, and I'll quote, a situation in which a respondent suffers a flat tire on the way to his immigration hearing may constitute an exceptional circumstance. So it seems to be that the IJ is signaling that if his story is true, this might be a basis for granting him what he's asking in his motion. But we don't think that he's presented sufficient evidence to actually show that that's what happened. And so here's the problem. If the IJ isn't following the evidentiary rule that we have announced decades ago, but also signaling that, you know, if it had, then it would have granted the motion, how do we not have a problem here?
I'm not sure I agree with the reading of the IJ's decision or the board's decision, and I believe that one of the agency entities, and I'm not sure.
I guess you speak up a little bit.
I'm sorry. I'm not sure if it was the IJ or the board said that the petitioner's evidence, while not inherently unbelievable, is still insufficient. But I don't think they say if it was sufficient, it would be an exceptional circumstance. I think they recognize that you have to look at the totality of the circumstances.
Well, I just read you the line from the IJ's decision, and it doesn't commit. I agree with that. But it does say this type of situation may constitute. So it doesn't make a finding that, you know, this story about a tire being flat is never going to work, so it doesn't matter, right? If we had that statement in the agency's decision, then we might not be having this conversation at all, because we'd be looking at that with the level of deference that we give those decisions. But we have a statement here where it's like, well, maybe this is enough, except for we're now going to say that you don't have enough evidence for your story in any event.
I think the IJ's decision is it might be sufficient in some circumstances, not in this circumstance here where we have a history of noncompliance with the immigration judge's orders, a prior instance where this individual failed to appear for a hearing, a claim that is largely uncorroborated. And the only piece of corroborating evidence that was submitted doesn't actually corroborate the claim. That's the totality of the circumstances. And those are factors that this court approved of in its en banc decision in Monteo, to say these are circumstances that you look at to say that this is not an exceptional circumstance.
I don't read Monteo as addressing the evidentiary burden at all.
In terms of?
It's addressing, like, what can constitute an exceptional circumstance, that sort of, that threshold showing. Mm-hmm. It doesn't address at all the evidentiary burden that you have to meet to make that sort of a showing.
It doesn't. It tells you what the agency can look at as factors to determine whether something is an exceptional circumstance. And the agency goes through those factors here and says, you have a history of noncompliance. You didn't corroborate your claim. It might not be inherently unbelievable, but it's not corroborated and it's not persuasive. And that is within the realm of the board's discretion or the IJ's discretion to make that determination. And it's fully consistent with the factors that are laid out in Monteo.
Yeah, I guess that's what the deemed true cases, what sets this case apart from those would be this, what you're calling history of noncompliance, that he actually had failed to make another meeting. So it seems to me, got to be right that if he had blown 10, if he had failed to attend 10 things in a row, and then he shows up, and for the 10th one, he says, hey, I got a flat tire. Under Monteo's totality of circumstances, I can't imagine, we can't say the agency can't take all that into account, and that somehow the deemed true rule means you got to believe that last one, you just ignore the fact that he blew the other 9. So the question, I guess, is how does that work when he only blew one previous meeting and failed to comply, but I think it was something he was supposed to file, they didn't file or something?
Yeah, he blew one previous hearing. He didn't file his asylum application on time, and then is now statutorily precluded from asylum unless he can show exceptional circumstances.
So that's your path to winning if we agree with you under the Monteo deemed true, and we don't have to mess with any of that.
Absolutely.
If we rule against you on the deemed true rule, what does that mean?
Well, I think it would be inconsistent with the court's current precedent on the totality of circumstances approach to in absentia removal orders. I think it would be flatly contradictory there.
That's why I'm having trouble understanding why, because you can certainly say we believe what he said, but under totality of circumstances, he still loses.
Yes.
But in the IJ's opinion, he said, I don't believe what he said. And that's the whole analysis, that his presentation wasn't credible. How is that consistent with the deem as true rule?
It's on the final page of the IJ's decision, respondent's supporting documents do not render the claims in his motion to reopen inherently unbelievable.
What page are you looking at?
I'm looking at, Your Honor, it's page 47 of the record.
Okay, I'm looking at it right now, last sentence. But the whole paragraph is about how the IJ is not believing the story. Correct?
No, Your Honor, it's not. It's the sufficiency of the evidence. If I could read it to you real quick. Does not render the claims in his motion to reopen inherently unbelievable. Nonetheless, a non-citizen claiming exceptional circumstances resulted in the failure to appear must provide adequate documentary evidence to support his claim of exceptional circumstances, and such evidence should corroborate the cause for his late appearance.
How is that consistent with our rule that says that unless your story is just facially unbelievable, we're going to take your story without corroborating? Because that rule suggests that you don't need corroboration. You need your own statement that this is what happened.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Your Honor. They can believe his story and still find that it's not an exceptional circumstance.
Sure, but not on the grounds of you didn't corroborate it.
Right.
That is certainly one factor that the agency can consider in the totality of the circumstances in making the exceptional circumstances determination.
I don't understand how that jives with this rule of, because we don't have hearings at this stage of the proceedings, we are going to accept your story unless it is facially or inherently unbelievable. What you're arguing means that rule means nothing.
I don't think it means nothing, but I think you run into a circumstance where a pro se individual who has assistance from counsel drafting the motion to reopen can say pretty much anything, and that gets them over the evidentiary burden.
And we have that a can't be the standard. In the law, which says that if it's facially unbelievable or obviously unbelievable, we're not going to buy it. But and I guess, I mean, we have other cases that say that if you have had, before the moment of this of a motion to reopen, if you have had evidentiary proceedings before where evidence has been presented and tested, then the agency can look at that. It doesn't have to facially accept anything that evidence relates to and can look at the testing of that evidence. Because there's been a proceeding where you can actually ask questions and test that. But we're here at a motion to reopen stage where there's no ability to do that.
But we're here at the motion to reopen stage where the statute provides that you should submit evidence to support your motion to reopen. You can't just make bald assertions. There has to be something to support what you say. And here, the only
question on the interaction between a statement that somebody makes at the motion open and our rule that says that's deemed true unless it's inherently unbelievable. And you can have a situation where there's no other evidence. There's just that person's statement. It seems to me that under our rule, right or wrong, it would be deemed true. But if there's other stuff in the record, like this person's prior behavior, like purported corroborating evidence that isn't actually corroborating, my thought was that under the totality of circumstances, the agency is totally appropriate, in fact, necessary for the agency to take all of that into consideration, notwithstanding our deemed true. In other words, I could come up with a hypothetical where there's just a ton of evidence in the record that cuts against that, what the person's saying. And I don't think we'd have to narrowly look at, the agency gets to look at everything. And I don't think our deemed true would over, but what is your position on that?
I agree with you 100%. I think that's exactly what the court was saying in Monteo.
But if they did that, I think what my colleagues are getting at, it does seem when you read that last paragraph, I guess penultimate paragraph in the IJ's decision here, it does seem like the IJ was coming to the conclusion that, and you seem to be resisting this, but that I don't believe that he had a flat tire. And I think he was coming to that because of his statement combined with these other things, which just seems like you're saying you can take into account. But you seem to be saying, no, he deemed it true, but then I don't understand. If he deemed it true, then the fact that he didn't show up at a prior hearing and all this stuff is kind of irrelevant.
I'm sorry, my time has expired. May I go ahead?
No, of course.
Yeah, I don't think that's quite right. I think it's not inherently unbelievable, but given all of the totality of the circumstances, even if it's true, the board doesn't have to find that it's an exceptional circumstance that warrants reopening,
agreed,
given the history of noncompliance and things like that. And that's exactly what the court said.
If we looked at this and we concluded that the IJ, the agency, because the BIA follows it, the agency made a mistake in the treatment of his statement,
yes,
wouldn't at a minimum we remand it? And maybe the agency would look at this record again and say, nonetheless, because he's missed a hearing and because of these other things, we still think that it doesn't. And maybe they're going to reach that decision. But wouldn't we need to remand because the agency seems to be making a decision based on an evidentiary premise that may not be correct, and we couldn't, like, fix that for the agency by saying, but, you know, maybe, you know, we could set that aside and say that because he failed to appear, that's good enough. Like, the agency didn't base its decision on that. The agency based its decision, at least in part, it seems to me, on they don't think he's truthful.
I disagree with that, but I think if you found that, you would have to remand to the board.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate
it. Thank you.
We'll go 3 minutes.
Thank you, and I'm conscious of the suggestion that we don't expire all our time.
Can I ask you the question I asked your colleague, which is, assuming the deemed true rule applies here, so the agency, you know, hears him say, I was 5 minutes late because I had a flat tire, how does, under our totality of circumstances requirement, what does the agency do with that if it thinks it has other evidence in the record, here his past performance and attending hearings and filing things, combined with providing corroborative evidence that the agency didn't see as corroborating at all? How does that all play in?
Right.
Do they still have to just deem it true, what he said, or do they get to put that all in the hopper in deciding whether or not they believe it?
In my mind, and I don't know if this is exactly the right way to articulate the disconnect, but in my mind, the deemed true rule and the evidentiary standard more or less collapse into the same thing. And we then move on
to... It more or less collapses.
In terms of... So the evidentiary quantum is essentially related to the deemed true rule. I don't understand the court's precedence as saying the totality of circumstances we're looking at. Evidence is a big factor here. A lot of our discussion has been about that, but I think it's more things like, what did the respondent have to lose or gain by missing this hearing? What was their past tenure of appearances like?
I guess what I'm asking is a simpler question, which is, she didn't have this rule that says, because you can't test it, we just have to accept what they say is true when they make a statement. But that also seems to be a rule we made up under the idea of there's no opportunity, there's nothing else to, we can't just disbelieve them when there's nothing else in the record for us to, but here this case illustrates sometimes there is other stuff in the record. And I'm trying to figure out how that, does the deemed true rule override whatever else is in the record? So we still have to deem something true, or the agency still has to deem it true, even if there's stuff in the record the agency thinks cuts against that?
Right.
Or does the deemed rule true go away completely when there's other stuff in the record, or is there a balance here, which is what the agency normally does?
By my lights, those other indicia in the record don't go to the evidentiary quantum. They go to whether we consider. So in other words, you made the point earlier, Judge Van Dyke, that if this is someone's first mistake, that weighs differently than it's their 10th, right?
But not if we have to deem true that they, I mean, if it was their 10th mistake and they come in and say, we had a flat tire, and the deemed true rule just wipes out all of the fact that you can look at those other nine. So that's why I'm asking. Yeah. Like, it seems to me it has to be that the agency still has the discretion to look at it all, and our deemed true rule doesn't. What is your position?
I would concede in a very careful analysis that laid exactly all that out, that all these other factors are basically against the respondent. We don't find...
Well, that's what it seems to me the IJ's decision in that penultimate paragraph does. The government has a little bit of an odd position about that, where I'm not sure I understand the government's position, but it seems to me that IJ's saying, it says this, it acknowledges the deemed true rule, and then it says, yeah, but there's this other stuff. And I think we're all kind of... come to think the IJ said, I don't believe it.
Right. And that may well have been the case.
And what's that?
That may well have been the case. Again, I have a suspicion that the IJ fundamentally did not accept it as true.
And then I thought your position was, and that violates the deemed true rule.
Yes. But then even aside from that, and I'm going over time, even aside from that, there are other factors in the record, right? There's what did the respondent have to lose? What has their track record been like? Has this person taken accountability for past failures to appear? Does this person seem to have a meritorious claim? What would the results be? Would the results be unconscionable? All those things. And again, the 28-J letter that the government provided with regard to Montejo speaks a little bit to this unconscionable results piece, right? That's principally there. That goes both to the merits of the claim and also, in my mind, to a balancing of what was the quantum of the mistake, a failure to appear versus arriving 5 minutes late to a satellite court versus how robust the claim seems to be.
All right. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you
both for the argument. You guys got a lot of questions, hot bench for your case. Interesting matter. This matter is submitted. We'll call the next case.